Good morning. Education systems are back in the state's control under the Every Student Succeeds Act, and that's how that's evidenced in Hawaii, is the business of the governor's ESSA team. On this National Teacher Appreciation Day, we'll talk with Daryl Galera, chairperson of the group charged with creating a blueprint for Hawaii education. And if it's Tuesday, it's Neil Conan analyzing the news from the farm. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Bill Sage. Start with a sturdy stem, and a solid trunk develops on the learning tree, especially when that stem is science, technology, engineering, and math education for keiki, especially girls. Leslie Wilkins joins us with a preview of the 7th Annual STEM Conference. And a lost technology is rediscovered and restored. Delani Tanahi shares the secrets of perpetuating kapa.
That's the conversation for this Tuesday, May 3rd. Here's the news.
You know, there was a wonderful movie, Beth Ann, called If It's Tuesday, This Must Be Belgium. But my thought is, if it's Tuesday on the conversation, it must be educational.
Well, today it is. You're right. Good morning, Bill Sage. And good morning, everyone. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. And yes, indeed, we're going to talk education this morning. As we mentioned a little earlier, it's National Teacher Appreciation Day. And you know, too, that for the better part of this century, states have been trying to grapple with the 2002 federal law No Child Left Behind. That is until last December. That was when a bipartisan measure, the Every Student Succeeds Act, became the latest reauthorization of the 50-year-old Elementary and Secondary Education Act. In short, it gave back to the states most of the authority over their education systems, and how that will change Hawaii's K-12 schools is now the job of the governor's ESSA team. Daryl Galera is the chairperson, and he's in our studio this morning. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Beth. Thank you.
For a lot of teachers and a lot of educators and principals, trying to grapple with No Child Left Behind wasn't easy, anything but. But there's also the idea that maybe some of the goals of No Child Left Behind weren't so bad. I mean, the idea of having high standards, the idea of having great accountability, being able to make sure that all children could achieve and that every child was really learning well seemed to be really good goals. But now we have No Child Left Behind morphing into being able to have more states have control over how these kids learn and what's happening in the system for each state. Under ESSA, how do you see that changing for Hawaii?
The ESSA law now, you know, devolves power back to the states, and so it provides a huge opportunity for each state and for districts to now design and set their own direction for public education in their areas. So it's a huge opportunity to where everyone is now in a state or district empowered, you know, to not so much to be dictated by, you know, mandates coming from up top, but now what's the best way to serve the needs of their communities and their school districts.
You bring up the idea of mandates from up top, and that sort of pulls us into a conversation about the Common Core and standards and tests. So let's take that apart a little bit. There are teachers who feel that the Common Core is absolutely the best thing that could happen so that it levels all learning and brings it to a certain place. There are teachers who say it's awful because it doesn't, it doesn't really allow it to be as responsive to the kids that you're really teaching. How do you reconcile those two ideas?
I think the way we work, we will reconcile those ideas are to, first of all, make sure we go and we talk and listen to our teachers in our schools and our classrooms. The Common Core as a set of standards may not be a bad set of standards, actually. They're high learning targets, they're high expectations. But again, when you step back and you understand that the Common Core standards are basically standards in reading or language arts and math, then a discussion will come about what about everything else? And so when you have a limited target, you can you then limit the teaching and learning that can happen in a school. So many educators remember before the Common Core, we had standards for all areas, whether it might be health and PE or fine arts or career and technical ed and social studies and so forth. And so, again, this when you look at the Common Core standards, again, an understanding of it is, you know, a specific set that may limit what happens in the schools.
You bring up that once upon a time we used to have standards for all subject matters, and there are a lot of teachers who teach social studies and science who say, we got left out. What happens to bring them back in?
Well, in science, I think many states are adopting the new science standards that are coming across, the next generation standards. And in social studies, there's a new set that's also coming out that people are looking at. But like we're saying here, if the focus has been limited, then you really narrow the curriculum, you narrow the teaching, and I think I think ESSA will give us a chance to take a look back at, okay, we understand reading and math are important, but so is everything else. And the law has a specific focus on teaching to the whole child. And so throughout the law, there's a lot of emphasis that we have to move away from this narrowing of the focus of teaching and learning and get to the whole child type of learning.
Part of that narrow focus seemed to be a result of the fact that across the nation, scores were falling and that kids weren't doing as well. And looking at where the United States had once been with its education system is clearly not where we are now. How can you move into creating kids who can truly, I don't want to say compete because that sounds, you know, a little maybe more tough, but maybe we need to be a little tougher in how kids are able to perform with their peers on a worldwide scale.
I agree. We need to have high expectations, and we need to make sure we have students strive to do their very best. Whether or not something like having more testing is the answer, we need to really step back and think about. When we talk about where our country has been in relationship to other countries and performance on other national tests, such as the PISA, for example, there are countries such as Finland and other places where they are doing very well, but they're not doing any testing of the type that we're talking about. So, but their focus is heavily on teaching and learning and providing engaging, rich, creative, innovative learning experiences for students.
Yeah, you make a good point about that. It's how are you going to assess what's being done in the classroom, and is it heavy reliance on testing? And we've got a lot of kids who are this week and last week engaged in testing.
Right.
And then again, there's the idea of how do you look at outcomes? What kind of outcomes are you looking for in terms of demonstrating mastery of knowledge? How do you do that? What makes the difference?
You know, the real focus on teaching and learning in the area of assessment is what I think many educators refer to assessment for learning, where we're looking at formative types of assessments, not so much the summative evaluative type of assessment. There's a role for all of that, but the research is clear when we are very intentional and focused and skillful in how we do our formative types of assessments, we will clearly have high increases in student learning. So again, these are some of the big issues that we have to start looking at and talking about more, about what really makes a difference and what priorities we set in terms of making good changes.
The governor's ESSA team has just begun to do its work, but you're its chairperson. What things have to be part of this new direction for you to feel that it's successful?
You know, it's a complex challenge. There are many facets and parts to it. One of the things that I think is important, you know, as a practitioner, as a teacher, as a school principal, I think what's most important is to understand the impact of policy on what actually happens in the classroom, what actually happens in the teaching and learning experiences, and also for principals, what happens in terms of their leadership effectiveness. And so I think one of the things I'm hoping our team will look closely at is, again, having a good understanding of what, you know, we look at in terms of policies and what actually happens. If we don't do that, then we can continue to implement policies and programs that may have further unintended consequences that may be negative and harmful to teaching and learning.
A lot of teachers are probably very happy to hear you say that. Thank you for coming in. We'll talk again.
Okay. Thank you, Beth.
Daryl Galera is chairperson of the governor's ESSA team and is retired from the Hawaii Department of Education after a 32-year career as a public school educator. He's now an education leadership consultant with the Hawaii Center for Instructional Leadership and the executive director for the Education Institute of Hawaii. That's a nonprofit think tank and advocacy group for improving education in Hawaii.
Dream a little dream of Ted Cruz.
Indiana's clearly the most conservative of the big Midwestern industrial states and may be ripe for Ted Cruz's message.
Indiana's GOP establishment can't explain why Donald Trump is the clear favorite in state polls. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, HPR2. It's now 8:17. Coming up, a status report on girls in STEM. First, your backyard quiz.
Today's backyard quiz takes us to the southwestern slopes of Haleakala on Maui. Until the mid-1800s, early Hawaiians farmed sweet potatoes, dryland taro, harvested wood, and hunted birds and pigs from the sandalwood and koa forests of the area. In 1856, a prominent member of the Royal Hawaiian Agricultural Society, Linton Torbert, famed farmed potatoes and corn here to supply Maui's merchant ships. At the direction of King Kamehameha III, Torbert planted sugar cane here as well. Cotton crops were also planted on this productive land to take advantage of the Union blockade of southern ports during the Civil War. A sugar mill was eventually built on this land, and in the late 1800s, the Dowsett family began ranching here. This backyard still operates as a ranch. For today's quiz, what is the modern-day name for this historic piece of farmland? Give us a call at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the HPR T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Jackson Button from Dream of a Better World. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Hawaii Public Radio's spring fund drive came to a successful close just a few weeks ago. We welcome new members and say thanks to our current members and to these community partners, Kanzaman, Madeline McKay, and Waldorf School of Honolulu. Mahalo for all of your support during Challenge 2016. We couldn't have done it without you.
Take the centuries-old learning technique of master teaching apprentice and apply that to every high electronic skill, starting with kids in the classroom. That, in essence, is the STEM approach to learning. STEM is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. This weekend, the 7th Annual STEM Conference happens on Maui, a good forum for explaining how hands-on high-tech education is encouraging our keiki. Women in Technology Project Director Leslie Wilkins joined us from Maui this morning. Aloha, Leslie.
Aloha and good morning.
Thank you so much for being with us. Well, after years of STEM in the schools, where are we now, would you say?
I think we're making significant progress. Given the tools, our students can compete globally and be innovators and creative thinkers, which is exactly what we need in our state as well as across the nation to prepare the future.
And especially with your interest, would you say that girls are catching up with the boys in STEM interest?
We are making progress. It's something we still have to be very proactive about. There's no question that girls and young women are excelling in education. Usually they are the top academic performers in many fields and subjects. They are getting college degrees at a larger pace than their male counterparts. They're getting more master's degrees and PhDs. So they are performing significantly well in education. The problem is that they are not self-selecting into the physical sciences, STEM, as you mentioned earlier, particularly computer science and engineering, as fast as their male counterparts. So there are many reasons for that. The research has been pretty comprehensive, both nationally as well as our own research here at home in Hawaii, that girls need to connect the dots with engineering, computer science, physics, to make sure that their study actually does something purposeful and meaningful and makes a difference in the world.
That's exactly what I wanted to bring up, because I noted through some of the statistics I've seen that in STEM jobs, 93% of them pay more than all other occupations. And right now, we still have the problem of just getting parity for women's pay in the jobs. Then one other thing that happened that I noticed, there's the overall job market. It's almost a 4-to-1 ratio of people looking for work, but in STEM, it's a reversal. There's nearly 2 STEM jobs for every unemployed person. And how are women seeing the monetary connection?
Excellent question. You're absolutely right. Our pipeline is not filled locally or nationally to meet the demand in STEM fields. It's a big concern for our nation as baby boomers are entering retirement. So quite frankly, girls and other underrepresented groups are the greatest resource for us to tap into to fill that pipeline. We have a big skill set mismatch as far as the skills people hold and the jobs that are available, as you identified. So the most important thing to do from a very young age with girls, our Native Hawaiian students, our Filipino-American students, those are students that have not been self-selecting as aggressively as their male counterparts, is to money is not necessarily the key that interests those students.
I guess that's the crux of the question.
It
so
is. If you survey a middle school male, he clearly identifies success, a successful future, a successful career pathway, as one that has big financial reward.
Now
and engineering and computer science, he usually will see that. You ask a girl the same age, middle school, and she has a more humanitarian career goal. She She often wants to contribute environmentally. She wants to contribute to improvement of health. She wants to make a difference in the world. She wants to work with people. Monetary goals are usually way down the list on what she may define as a career that will be exciting and meaningful. Trying to connect the dots.
if you may, the one thing we've always heard about nature versus nurture, I mean, there have been studies where they try to give little boys dresses and they will turn the dress into a weapon and little girls start dressing up the soldiers. So there appears to be the inherent desires of the genders, which is biologically programmed. But still, is there a magic bullet? Is there some sort of formula that gives the kids the interest, especially the young female students? Maybe in grade school, I guess when the brains are developing, the earlier you can interest them, the better. Is that possible? And if so, what are the techniques?
Absolutely. So far, I don't know that there's a magic bullet, but there are certainly many ways to keep our girls engaged. That's the main thing we want to do is stop them from leaking out of the pipeline, which happens a lot at the middle school level when they see that math is not of interest. They don't see how it's relevant to something what they want to do in the real world. They don't see it as very cool. So what we need to do is continue to choreograph, if you will, or connect the dots to show that learning technology is a very significant way of making a difference.
Almost as if, well, if you play on the genetic differences, you always see when in doubt, go shopping. Girls, if you really want to go shopping, the more money you have to go shopping, the better your chances of shopping. And the more you want that money, just any incentive to make people the carrot and the stick. I mean, again, science applied to practical observation. I'm just not sure myself, but I'm thinking it might help.
Well, I don't know that we go down that quite stereotypical pathway of the shopping analogy. What we usually try to do with looking at income potential and career pathways that will raise your income is that it builds choices.
Right.
That, you know, you can have the more money you have, the more knowledge-based skills you have, the more desirable you are for an employer, and that gives you more choices as to where you want to live. If you choose to have a family, what kind of provisions you can and opportunities you can provide for your family. So those are kind of where we make the connections. But most important, again, it goes back to wanting to make a difference. So we have to show that learning GIS, geospatial skills, learning computer science and program really can make huge impacts in our environment and measuring and mapping, maintaining and preserving our environment, clean energy research to make sure that, you know, the more technology skills and innovation that our girls get, the more they can make a difference in making us energy independent and not reliant on fossil fuels, et cetera. Healthcare right now is totally being driven by state-of-the-art technology to enhance early detection of major disease and treatments, and agriculture right now, the science of ag and looking at mechanization in agriculture is really important to look at preserving our agriculture future here in Hawaii, and that's a big topic here on Maui. So those are the things. So as soon as early as you can have an early coding class or an early GIS class and connect it to a real-world project that resonates with our girls and our boys, it really makes a difference in keeping them interested and engaged and understanding why studying STEM can really help them in their future to do what they want to do.
The sooner you can get them interested, the better the chance for the interest. Leslie, thank you so much for being with us this morning. Leslie Wilkins is Vice President and Project Director for Women in Technology Project, a co-sponsor of the 7th Annual STEM Conference. It happens on Maui this Friday and Saturday. Get more details on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. It's now 8:30. If you want to be in touch, you can call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. We're also on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. And coming up in just a little while, we're going to get Neil Conan's view of the news from the farm. And later, the lost art of technology of kapa revived and restored. First, here's a look at global events from the BBC. In Hawaii, almost $700 is what you probably waste every year on food you throw out. And it's only part of the reason some UH researchers have been studying what Hawaii wastes. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has an expensive reality check this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, you remember that during our last pledge drive, we had a zero-waste initiative.
Yeah, that's right.
And we also had Aloha Harvest coming to pick up whatever wonderful food was left over after various meals. And we were talking a lot about food waste, but the idea that we waste so much as a state and so much as a nation, especially here in Hawaii when it's so expensive, seems to be really daunting.
Yeah, let me lay out some of the statistics, and this is coming from a new report from University of Hawaii researchers. So we already know that we pay for more food than anybody else in the nation. That we have long known here. And we actually waste less per person when you compare it to everybody else. But still, we do end up throwing away more than one-fourth, about 26% of our food supply. That's 365 pounds of food per person every year. Again, that's less than the national average, but it adds up. That's 1.43 million pounds every single day across the aisles in wasted food.
So how do you get people to stop doing that? I mean, because clearly we know that we pay a lot for food. We all go to the grocery store and see the prices and then, you know, go through the refrigerator and have to throw things out when we didn't use them or we took leftovers home and didn't eat them.
All right. Well, one thing we could do is we could have more sustainable agriculture. That's something we've been pushing for some time. And the reason for this is not only is it good for the local economy, but remember how we import about 88% of our food? Well, it turns out that because it's coming into the ports in those containers and it's hot and it's humid, the food spoils faster. So about a third of that waste, the waste that we have for all our food supply, it doesn't even make it to our table. So there's something we could do. We could start pushing for more locally grown products. Another thing we could do is be more careful about what we do with our food. And one of the things our reporter checked on was the School of Trop Ag at UH. They have a program they started last year where they're actually returning food or giving food that is not used in UH facilities, dining facilities. They're taking that food and they're taking it to the Institute for Human Services, right? That's the homeless program downtown. Leftover bentos, leftover salads, fruits. They're really turning out to be perhaps a model program for other schools to take the food that's not being used and give it to humans so that they can use it.
There are also programs that were being sort of driven by the EPA. I remember when we were talking about that a couple of years ago, college campuses were, some of them at least in Hawaii, were looking to create a zero waste program as well. And the whole issue about, you know, wet food going to H-Power just doesn't make it work as effectively. And it's just sad to see all that food wasted.
Not only that, you shouldn't be putting it in the landfills. That's where most of it's going. And that can produce methane gas, which is a form of greenhouse gas. So that's not good. You know, you mentioned the EPA. In 2013, nationally, they said 37 tons per person, thrown out every year. Not a whole lot of it is going to composting. That's another thing that is recommended by the EPA and others, that we use more food for composting. Also for pigs and other animals that could use the food that we will not eat.
All more reasons to be really careful about the choices that we make. Hey, Chad, thank you.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
We'll talk to you in the morning.
Okay.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us every day with a reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer school for boys and girls in preschool through grade 12, with classes in digital media, art, robotics, and more. Full course listings at sacredhearts.org.
Today, Indiana could mark the last stand of the Stop Trump movement. Voters seem set to push the New York billionaire to the edge of the Republican presidential nomination. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders continues to vow to take his campaign to the floor of the Democratic convention. And then there's that tragic story of despair in the Pacific Island nation of Nauru, where two asylum seekers are set themselves on fire to protest Australia's immigration policies. Those are the stories on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan this week as he joins us from his Macnut farm on the Big Island, as he does most Tuesdays. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Okay, so let's pick up from last week. Now, you said that Indiana would mark the effective end of the Republican presidential nomination saga. Will it be all but over when the votes are counted in the Hoosier State a little later today?
Well, Bethann, I was wrong.
I love a man who can say that.
Donald Trump's five wins were much more comprehensive last week than I thought they would be. He won every congressional district, every county in those five states, and almost every available delegate. So while Ted Cruz has been working hard in Indiana and vows to keep on fighting, it's over.
Senator Cruz broke precedent to announce a running mate late last week. He said that Carly Fiorina would be his choice for vice president if he got the nomination. But how does all this fit now, you know, if the campaign is effectively over?
Well, yeah, desperate times, desperate measures. On top of the crushing defeats in the Northeast, it's been just a horrible week for Ted Cruz. The VP announcement fell flat as, the president-vice president team fumbled the salute. They couldn't find each other's hands to raise in that salute. Cruz held a rally in the basketball gym where the team from the tiny town of Hickory won a miracle championship immortalized in the movie Hoosiers, and all he got was mockery after he called the hoop not a rim but a ring. He got the endorsement of Governor Mike Pence. You'd think that would be important, but an incredibly lukewarm endorsement. Pence spent almost as much time praising Trump as he did praising Cruz, and then Trump got an arguably more important endorsement from the former basketball coach of Indiana University, Bobby Knight. Just a terrible week for Cruz.
Now, Notre Dame football coach Lou Holtz also came out for Trump, too. And the polls, of course, are showing Trump with a solid lead.
Yeah, John Kasich kept his part of that, you know, much-hyped agreement. And he did not campaign actively in Indiana, but that didn't make any difference, it turns out. The Fiorina announcement didn't make any difference. And what looked like a winnable primary as late as a week ago now looks totally out of reach, and Trump looks unstoppable. He will win the Republican nomination on the first ballot.
So what happens to the Republicans who have vowed never Trump? I mean, they've been running ads against him in Florida. You know, this was the group that, outside of the Cruz and Kasich campaigns, you know, what happens to all of these people now?
They have to decide. You know, some are going to rally around the party. Some will sit out the presidential election and work for Republican House and Senate candidates, and some will cross the lines and support Hillary Clinton as the lesser of two evils. It was interesting. I just saw a tweet from Mark Salter, who, of course, is a longtime associate of John McCain's and co-author of his books, supporting Hillary Clinton. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, who's also on PBS and NPR, Brooks calls this an historic moment, equivalent, he says, to McCarthyism. In the 50s, wow. Republicans have to be able to look their grandchildren in the eyes and say what they did when their party nominated such a totally unacceptable candidate, you know, a bigot who says such hateful things and condones violence at rallies, and is so ignorant of the world. Andrew Sullivan, another conservative writer, went even further. He called this an extinction event for the party, a step toward tyranny, and I'm not sure how many in the party rank and file are going to follow intellectuals like them. But watch what the Bushes do. Watch Mitt Romney and watch John McCain, the last two nominees, and watch Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and the man who's going to be holding the gavel when that convention starts in Cleveland.
All right, let's flip over to the less apocalyptic side. Hillary Clinton's victories last week were almost as big as Trump's. Bernie Sanders did win Rhode Island. Her lead is about as big as it was before he had that run where he won 7 out of 8. But he refuses to concede. He said on Sunday that he will take his campaign all the way to the convention in Philadelphia.
And his frustration with the party and the process and with Hillary Clinton is beginning to show. She irritates him even more by clearly turning to the general election and to Donald Trump and all but ignoring him and acting the part of the presumptive nominee. He fulminates at the establishment that he says rigged the system against insurgents like him. And then he argues that he still has a path to win the nomination if superdelegates, of course, which is that very same establishment, abandon Secretary Clinton and flip to him.
Abandon the candidate who's won the most states, the most votes, and the most delegates, too?
Absolutely right. So that's not going to happen. The polls show he's close in Indiana. He could win West Virginia and Kentucky later this month. It's close in California. I have to say that Clinton is ahead both in Indiana and California, according to the polls. But Clinton looked very solid in New Jersey. And the last contest is Washington, D.C., which will be a blowout win for her. It's just not going to happen for him. Hillary Clinton will win easily on the first ballot. Now, of course, he's perfectly justified to stay in the race to give his supporters an opportunity to vote, but he needs to decide when to accept defeat and focus on Donald Trump. And it's getting to the point now where, you know, some of his diehard supporters are enlisting in the Bernie or bust effort. Tens of thousands of them say they'll vote Green Party or not vote at all. And some even think he's setting himself up to run as an independent.
Didn't he say, though, at the start of all this, just a year ago, didn't he say that he really didn't want to be a Ralph Nader? That he would join the Democratic Party and run just as a Democrat.
Yeah, and I don't think he wants to squander everything he's accomplished. As he always reminds us, a year ago when he made that decision, he was at 3% in the polls. He has done amazing things. He has changed the party. He's changed Hillary Clinton. He's energized a new generation. But his fundraising is down. He's laid off a couple of hundred campaign staff. That's never a good sign. Now, in the Senate, Sanders has a reputation as, you know, yes, an idealist, but a pragmatist, too, to get what's gettable. Push the party. So, you know, he can push the party on $15 minimum wage. He can, the goal of universal health care or free college tuition, push for rules changes on superdelegates, and he may not get all of that, but get what's gettable and learn to live with it.
Which is why the whole tenor of his campaign seems to be changing. But, okay, I don't want to let you go without asking you about this truly terrible story. You've been following it in the Pacific News Minute about the Australian detention camp in Nauru, where two asylum seekers set themselves on fire in protest. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the first is an Iranian man. He died of his injuries. The second, a young woman from Somalia, is in very serious condition in the hospital in Australia. This goes back 4 years, 2011, 2012. The number of migrants trying to reach Australia by boat surged. Obviously, these are desperate people, Iranians, Kurds, Somalis, Bangladeshis, Rohingyas. They paid people smugglers who overloaded them aboard rickety boats, and no one can say for sure, but dozens of people are believed to have drowned. Australia says its policy is designed to deter those boats. They insist no one who tries to come in illegally by sea will ever get asylum in Australia. So they set up camps on remote islands, one in Papua New Guinea and one on Nauru, to detain these migrants while their claims to asylum were processed. If they're found to qualify as refugees, they will be resettled, but in Nauru or PNG, not Australia. Mm-hmm. And they even made a deal to resettle people in Cambodia. And, you know, on the one hand, the deterrence part of this seems to have worked. Many fewer boats are making the attempt. On the other, the offshore detention camps have been a disaster. No more than a handful of people have been resettled anywhere. And after more than 2 years in limbo, people are really getting desperate.
So how many people are we talking about?
About 350 men, women, and children in Nauru, another 850 on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. They're all men there. So the numbers are not huge, but the Australian government argues this is just the tip of the iceberg. If they let these migrants into Australia, tens of thousands will follow. Their critics say the policy is racist and inhumane. But this may be coming to a head now. The Supreme Court in PNG just ruled that the camp there is unconstitutional and has to be closed. So Australia needs to figure out what to do with those 850 men. The government's reaction to the self-immolations on Nauru has sounded awfully callous. And there's about to be an election in Australia in early July. And immigration policy is clearly going to be a big issue.
And I know that we're going to keep following that and having more conversations about it. Thanks, Neil. Talk to you next week.
You bet, Beth Ann.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us from the farm most Tuesdays. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Hi, good morning. I'm Jared Kuroiwa from Oceanic. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Imagine being told that knowing how to make cloth essential to your culture is a lost art, that all the people who know the technique are long dead and gone. And now imagine this bad news is told to you in 1870 in the Kingdom of Hawaii. That's exactly what happened then. Hawaiian kapa making was a lost art, but over a century later, love, determination, research, and hard practical efforts brought it back to life. And today it thrives again. We're glad to have one of the most dedicated practitioners of kapa making, Dalani Tanahi, joining us by phone this morning. Aloha, Dalani.
Aloha. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very, very welcome. This is fascinating. Even back in the days of the kingdom, kapa was a lost art. And, of course, before we get into that, tapa versus kapa, you explain that.
Oh, well, it's more a matter of semantics. Because people were so used, especially in Hawaii, people were really used to seeing South Pacific tapa. Mm-hmm. And tapa, by the way, is kind of a catch-all name. All cultures had their own specific names to describe bark cloth, the right. process, and the plants. And when I started doing this and teaching it, I started referencing all of the Hawaiian bark cloth as kapa, mostly to put a new image in people's minds, because our work is very different from Samoan, Tongan, Fijian. They all have their differences.
Right.
And I started calling it kapa just so when people thought of kapa as opposed to tapa, they would have a different image in their mind of what they think of when they hear tapa, like the tapa bar and
right.
that kind of thing like that. So.
Exactly. So with they don't really use the T in modern Hawaiian anymore, or maybe Tawai, some of the older dialects, Niihau.
Yeah, Niihau style and like that. But over here, we call it kapa, and that's what people pretty much know now we're talking about the Hawaiian version of the bark cloth.
So the Hawaiian Renaissance, which started a century later, especially I mean, when it comes to kapa, is
mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Well, I think during that time, you know, with the hokulea and these kind of things, people, you know, days that happened in 59, by the 70s, people were looking back and going, hey, you know, we did a lot of cool things. Let's go and revisit some of that stuff, like open ocean voyaging. And some of the arts that people started looking at were kapa. And in the late 60s and early 70s, there were a few people who were kind of inspired to go and start doing that. Malia Solomon, Pua Van Dorp, and then Marie McDonald and Moana Isley. And none of these people started, and everyone kind of got into it for their own reasons. People didn't start doing it as a group of women who said, hey, let's all do kapa. People kind of just found their own calling and started doing it. I started doing it in about 1996, so almost 20 years now, and I was lucky that I was hired to teach this to children.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I learned it, I was actually learning it as a teacher/student. And that's pretty much been the theme of many of us because, you know, as it being an art that people stop,
haumana,
then
kumu,
we've had
kumu,
to really
haumana.
Just kind of find it from the DNA.
Exactly. So the research must have, I mean, a lot of it had to be really, really hands-on because of so much, sort of like I think of Maupiai Log and getting non-instrument
mm-hmm,
navigation back.
Mm-hmm.
So where's the hands? You guys just go, is it Vauke or Vauke? Which is the correct pronunciation?
Vauke or Vauke, either one.
Okay.
You know, there was a lot of material about it because so much about kapa and tapa was written by observers from, you know, the people on Captain Cook's boats and the voyagers and the whalers and the missionaries all the way down to, you know, in Kamakau and John Papa'i'i, they all wrote extensively about kapa. It was very beloved, and, you know, a lot of it ended up in Europe and collections all over the world because people really loved it and were impressed with it.
Supreme irony. Where do you find it? Learn from right. Europe. What?
Well, really. I mean, it was really, I was at British Museum last year, and they have a huge, huge collection. They finally did the first exhibit of some of their 900 pieces of Polynesian bark cloth that they have. So people really did love it. And, you know, the only ones who didn't write about it, interestingly, were the Hawaiian women who, at the time, in the mid-1900s, were very capable of writing about it. And kind of, you know, with all the things that happened, with all the sectors that kapa was used in, it began to seem to me that the Hawaiian women did not have a huge problem embracing the new technology of fabric, which was not new. It was being introduced to them from the very beginning of the sea captains. People kind of like to throw down the Christians did it thing. But really, women were being exposed to fabric for a very long time.
Like the palaka cloth.
You know,
in
Hawaii, the Hawaiian kapa got better and better and better after contact because they got metals to make better tools. They got new dyes. They saw fabric. They got impressed with a lot of these things, and they really changed up their kapa from what was gathered during Captain Cook's time up to the time they stopped by the end of the, of the 1800s.
So a rough nutshell. We've only got about 2 minutes right now, but you start with your own oki tree in the backyard, if possible. If you get some, just grow your own, essentially, and go from there.
Essentially, you have to. If you're going to be a practitioner, you need to have the bulky, or at least a lot of the people will help out at different botanical gardens, and they'll help take care of those vulcae and then get to use it. But, it's not a difficult plant to grow. It can get all over the place, but it's first thing you need to have, definitely.
Yes, I guess for some reason, a lot of people think there must be this paper mulberry tree, this huge. No, it's a very, very small thing, and you have to be very delicate in doing it. The techniques that you've talked about, it's not that easy at first, but you just do it, and you do it, and you learn, and you learn.
Exactly. That's the best way to learn is just keep doing it.
How about the dyes and everything else and the beaters and the watermarking?
Exactly. And that's kind of one of the things that made kapa and continues to make kapa not as huge as an art, is that there are so many components to it. You have to make tools. You have to find your dyes. You have to grow your plants. You have to make your stamps and do all these things. There are many arts within the art of kapa making. It's not just get a tree and sit down and pound it. Where's that tree coming from? Where's that beater coming from? Where's that anvil coming from? Where's that time coming from? Because it is still very time consuming. People always ask me, hey, what if we made a machine to make that kapa? I said, yeah, and we'll call it paper, because I'm pretty sure that's what they already do. The whole romance of it is the fact that we still sit and very laboriously and very lovingly are tapping and tapping and pounding and pounding and hoping the neighbors don't complain when you're out there at 9 o'clock at night still beating that kapa.
Everything old is new again. I wish we could go on and on, but unfortunately the time just burns through. But I want to thank you so much, and I know that there's going to be lectures and exhibitions. So, Dalani, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Dalani Tanahi is helping make Hawaiian kapa and teaching others how to do it for over 20 years. Ho'omau, the Perpetuation of Kapa exhibit, opens this Friday at the Hawaii State Art Museum, and Dalani will be telling the story of kapa there at noon on May 31st. Our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, has details.
Now we're going to get back to our backyard quiz. Earlier in the show, we visited a fertile backyard on the island of Maui. It has produced numerous crops for local and mainland consumption, and the place we asked you about today currently operates as a ranch and Maui's only winery. The land was purchased from the Baldwin family in 1963 by Pardee Erdman and continues to be operated by the Erdman family. In the late 1960s, Pardee Erdman began the tradition of partnering with organizations to help preserve the native flora on the ranch land. Currently spanning about 18,000 acres, the ranch is actively partnering with 8 different organizations, including the Nature Conservancy, the Native Hawaiian Plant Society, and the Leeward Haleakala Watershed Restoration Partnership. They do that to protect and enhance the native habitat on the Ulupalakua Ranch. And that's the answer to today's quiz. It's now 8:56. If you've got a quiz for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
I think it's really amazing how the fact that young ladies or women can really get into more technology with the right stimulus and interest. And I don't know if I was slightly off the mark in trying to explain just a suggestion from a male point of view about maybe if the economic incentives are linked in to some of the emotional. But as a guy, you know, sometimes.
Well, and with a guy, I mean, that was, I think, what Leslie Wilkins was saying, is that guys were really directed toward the consumerist part of it, the getting mm-hmm. of the stuff. And, hey, that's not to say that young girls aren't, too. I mean, if you go out there and you talk to middle school
girls in the mall, right?
Yeah, that's a big one there, too. But her point that there's also this humanitarian driver.
Oh, sure.
And how do you begin to, you know, sort of approach that and access that idea as well as the, you know, financial reward of having a job that pays you something.
Scientific observation, I mean, the science of getting the art, the hard sciences taught, I mean, it's still where arts and science come together, the art of convincing someone that science is something that is practical economically, and then the benefits of the science application for betterment of the whole technology. And yet doing that in an adolescent mind, be it young adolescent male or adolescent female, there's a technique that bears more scientific research, I'm thinking.
That
but
too.
I'm just a guy.
Well, you're just a guy. But you got some good things to say, Guy. Thanks very much for joining us today. And that's going to do it for us for this morning. Up tomorrow, we'll talk with the vice president of the Thomas Fordham Institute, who says that Hawaii is right on standardized testing. We'll continue our education conversation tomorrow.
Plus, Joan Lander, co-founder of Namaka Okaena, talks about the upcoming OEVE Film Festival.
And as we mentioned to you several times in the program, we love to hear from you. You can call the Talk Back line at 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me and I'll tweet back at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of the show and want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics there too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of the Conversation.